All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome to Computer Science E7. So today, of course, we have to talk about the histogram. But as you know, we seem to be perpetually behind this semester. So I thought I would start this lecture with a movie, actually. So let's begin. Okay.
These television lenses start with a very precise design. A diamond blade slices up a block of specially selected optical glass, while coolant prevents the blade from burning it. The slices then go under a diamond drill, which cuts several puck-sized discs from one glass slice. The operator is careful to keep waste to a minimum. Optical glass costs up to $1,000 per kilogram. The optical glass sits on a thinner piece of glass covered with wax. As the wax is melted, the discs are easily pulled away. Next, a device spins one of the discs while a wheel overhead sculpts it into a lens. Checks each lens for chips, and this one looks smooth. This tar-like substance is called pitch. The edges of the lenses have been built up with tape to contain the pitch. They completely coat the underside of the lens with it. Several pitch-covered lenses are now in a metal shell. A worker picks up a hot aluminum dome called a blocking body. He presses it onto the pitch-covered lenses, and the pitch melts onto it. Dousing it with water causes the pitch to harden, sealing the lenses to the blocking body. Body is now upside down and acting as a holding device as it oscillates on a spinning grinding shell. The grinding makes the surface of the lenses uniform and smooth. They place a polisher on the lenses. It's lubricated with a very fine abrasive. For about an hour, the polisher oscillates while the block spins. Polishing makes the lenses smooth and transparent. It also gives them an even more curved profile. Have been removed from the block, and it's time to cut the diameter down to size. Using a microscope, a technician centers a lens between two brass chucks. A diamond blade at the back cuts the lens as the technician monitors it. He's making sure the diameter and axis of the lens have a common center. Next, they group some lenses on round racks called planets. Their universe is a vacuum chamber. The technician closes the door, and the planets continue their orbit. Inside this vacuum, an electron beam evaporates coating materials. The vapor rises to give the lenses a protective coat. A computer monitors the rate of evaporation and the coating. But there's much more to come. Up next, this process really gets visual as all the pieces of the camera lens come together. spent 3 hours getting a protective finish. It's time to wipe away any residue and make sure they're perfect. This particular lens is concave. She covers it to protect it while she cleans and inspects a lens with the opposite profile, convex. Then the convex lens goes to another technician who places it in a holding device. He looks into a microscope and adjusts the position of the lens until it's optically centered. He uses wax to keep the lens from shifting in the holding device. They give the lens another cleaning. Each one must be absolutely spotless before they proceed to the next step. Otherwise, dust particles could become trapped within the optical system and affect image quality. Now that the surface of the convex lens is immaculate, she dabs optical cement onto the center of it. Gives the other concave lens a little more scrutiny before she cements it onto the convex lens. She applies pressure to spread the cement between the two lenses. Cementing them together means they'll be less likely to shift around in the lens barrel. She checks for dust one more time. Then it's under the microscope for an optical alignment of this double lens. Because the cement isn't yet dry, he can push the top lens around and adjust its position. Next, they prep the barrel that will hold the lenses. The technician traces out lettering using a stylus, attached to a sharp tool that engraves information onto the lens barrel. Technical details that will tell the photographer just what the lens will do. Things like focal length, the f-number, and the size of the aperture opening. These reference points allow the user to pull a picture into focus at the desired magnification. Now they double-check the design for this complex optical system and begin to pull all the pieces together. Or single lens goes into the metal barrel first. Other lenses with various curvatures and dimensions follow. She places metal spacers between the lenses to separate them. Proper spacing will prevent aberrations in the image, such as blurring. Between installations, she covers the barrel with a piece of lint-free plastic because eliminating dust continues to be a necessity. One fleck could ruin this entire assembly. Using tweezers, she coaxes the last lens into the barrel. She installs a retaining ring to hold the stack of lenses down. Then she locks it into place. There's one final inspection. She examines the assembled optical lens from all angles. It takes a total of 6 weeks to make one of these optical lenses. And in the end, it's picture perfect.
That was a video from the Discovery Channel's very fun How It's Made program, and they do a pretty good job, I think, of showing us at least how they mentioned early on that it was a television lens, but for all intents and purposes, we can consider a television lens and the lenses that we attach to the front of our cameras pretty much the same. And I think it really goes to show just how much effort that a manufacturer has to put into to create one of these lenses. Like I mentioned before, these are not simple systems. They're complex systems, and especially now that they are able to use computers to help the optical engineers create really well-designed systems, it is even more complicated. And to this day, many of the lenses that we attach to our cameras are, in fact, handmade. Some of them are not, but many of them continue to be made by people in factories, just like you saw here. And this show is actually kind of funny because they make cheesy puns, and they have cheesy music, and they show this, you know, sort of funny or humorous stock footage of whatever widget they're showing was made, but it's always that stock footage. It's always that widget that's being made on top of a pedestal in a park. And they just sort of, you know, move the camera around it, and it's just sort of funny. Like, why on earth do they put it in a park? But anyway, it's something funny that I think you might notice if you pay attention or if you watch that show. It sort of fits in well, I think, with this class. So last week, at the end of the week, we were talking about the hyperfocal distance and how you can use this. If you set the hyperfocal distance properly, this maximizes the depth of field, and the depth of field is the range of in focus area in front of your lens. So it might be everywhere from 2 feet all the way to infinity in front of your lens. Or it might be much narrower. It could be just a few inches wide, maybe a few feet in front of your lens. It really depends on the many factors that we discuss that affect the focus distance, which include the circle of confusion, the F number, the focal length that you use, a variety of these things. But there is this one set of variables that you can use for any lens at any focal length that will maximize the depth of field on your camera. And that is the hyperfocal distance. And this will put everything from half of the focus distance all the way to infinity in focus in front of your camera. That's what makes this special. That's what makes the hyperfocal distance special, is that it is everything from whatever distance is called the focus distance, everything from half of that all the way to infinity will be in focus. And if we pay attention to here, if you don't actually have a calculator with you or that DOF Master website right in front of you, and you happen to have an older lens attached to your camera, you can actually use the markings on that lens to try to figure out the hyperfocal distance. Many of these older lenses will have these little hash marks that show you the range, the depth of field in front of the camera. And all you have to do is set one end of that hash mark for a given f-stop. So you notice that there's this light blue hash mark at the outside. That represents, that's color-coded to the f-numbers that you see here. So 16 is light blue, for example. 11 is yellow, eight is green, so on and so forth. And you can see how the larger f-numbers have a wider range of depth of field, a wider range of in-focus areas. So if you choose one of these f-numbers, so for example, f16, which will maximize the depth of field for us, and you put one end of that right at infinity, the other end will be at one half of the focus distance. We can actually see that this is set at the hyperfocal distance for this lens at this focal length with this F number. And the way that we can tell is just by looking at the numbers. We can see that the focus distance is just over 5. It's maybe about 5.5 feet or something like that. And we can see that it extends from about 2 3/4 all the way to infinity. But many of the modern lenses, unfortunately, have lost this same thing. This is a photo of a modern lens where they just have the center of the focus. They don't actually have the extent through which our depth of field allows. And we lose this sort of nice mechanical way of calculating the hyperfocal distance. So we have to fall back to a calculator or using the function, this equation rather, or any number of other ways of calculating the hyperfocal distance. Now, going back to this idea that lenses are very, very complicated, they have increased the complexity of lenses in recent years by adding optical image stabilization. And many, many cameras now have this feature, and by cameras, I actually mean lenses. It's just that a number of lenses actually have this built in, but by nature of compact cameras having one lens built into the camera, we can think of it holistically as the camera having this feature as well. But there is actually a distinction where this optical image stabilization takes place. And different manufacturers will call it different things. So Canon, for example, calls it IS for image stabilization. And Sigma, third-party manufacturer, I think they call it OIS for optical image stabilization. Nikon calls it VR for vibration reduction. These are all the same words for the same thing. All this essentially means is that one of the many lens groups inside is connected to an actuator, which is just a little tiny motor. And that motor can move that lens up, down, left, right, in any variety of ways. And attached to that motor is a computer. And that computer senses the movement of that lens. So just as you hold a lens, you're going to shake it just very slightly. Even if you're trying to hold it very still, your hands are not the most stable platform ever made. So that you'll have just a slight amount of vibration. And the whole point of this system is try to counteract that. So as you move down slightly, this will try to counteract and move the lens up. So it's just this small lens element inside. And you can usually hear this working. It will usually be sort of a soft hum or sort of a high-pitched whine or any sort of sound like that when this is actually taking place. And it does actually work, and quite well, especially modern ones. They can actually reduce the shaking by quite a lot. So here's two pictures, for example, one with a picture taken with the IS off and one with a picture taken with the IS on. You can see that the one on bottom is much more stable. It does not have this sort of motion blur, just this very slight motion blur that happens as we try to hold a camera still as we take a photo. So image stabilization could, in effect, make our lenses, it's as if we would have faster lenses, because it's as if we can now hold this lens at a slower shutter speed. So maybe I took this photo up top, for example, at 1/8 of a second, and it was blurry. But now when I turn on IS, it's possible for me to handhold that same picture, or to handhold that same scene, or the camera, and take a picture of the same scene. Oh, but with IS on, I can take it at the same shutter speed and actually get a sharp image. So many of the image stabilization ratings are in terms of stops. So you'll see, for example, that some of the latest image stabilization technologies can actually reduce the vibration by about 4, maybe 5 stops, something like that. That's actually quite a bit. So what that's saying is that, let's say you have a big telephoto lens attached to your camera, and it's 200 millimeters, for example. Now, you might recall that many, many lectures ago, I said that there was a trick that you can remember that will help you figure out what the slowest shutter speed you can use to reasonably get a sharp photo out of that. And that was to use what? Right, so it's 1 over the focal length. So if we have a 200 millimeter lens, then 1 over 200 of a second is how fast we can reasonably expect to hold it. So let's say that holds true in this particular case. And I take a photo at 1/200th of a second and it's sharp, but 1/100th of a second and it's blurry. So 1/200th of a second is the shutter speed that I can use to take a sharp photo. Now, if this image stabilization says that I have a 4-stop advantage, that means that I can have 4 stops slower of a shutter speed and still get a sharp image. That means 1/100th of a second, 1/50th of a second, 1/25th of a second, 1/12th of a second, or 1/13th of a second. So that's 4 stops. And that's actually quite a considerable amount of difference. So 1/13th of a second compared to 1/200th of a second is actually really good for you to be able to get a sharp, hand-holdable photo. Now, there is a bit of confusion when it comes to this, and that is that just because you are able to take an image of still objects at a slower shutter speed doesn't mean that it's going to work miracles and actually stop time. What I mean by that is that this only stops the vibration in your hand. It does not stop the motion of the subjects that are moving in front of you. So, for example, if I was not taking a picture of this calculator, but instead I took a picture of an animal or a child or something that's going to be moving around relatively quickly, and I can take a sharp photo of that kid or that animal running around at 1/200th of a second, there's no amount of optical stabilization that can prevent that movement from actually happening. So if I take that same photo with IS on at 1/12th of a second, that is still going to be blurry, and that is just because of the fact that kid, for example, is still moving around relatively quickly, and we will get some motion blur as a result. So image stabilization is nice in that it helps us take some photos in lower light, but only in the case where we are moving, where the photographer is moving, or when the lens itself is moving, and not in the case where the subject is moving. So the fact that a lot of manufacturers have been putting IS on and using slower lens, using a smaller aperture like f5.6, saying that, oh, the IS helps counteract this slower aperture or this smaller aperture, doesn't really hold in all cases, because still having a fast aperture is useful for the cases where you need to have a faster shutter speed for your subjects that are actually moving around. Of course, IS is actually pretty useful for still subjects like this, but as we all know, we do not always take photos of motionless objects. And it's important to realize the difference between the two. So basically what happens is that there is something that moves inside of the camera. And I mentioned before that it might be a lens element inside of the lens. And that's the typical implementation now, where we actually have optical image stabilization where some glass element inside of the lens itself might move to counteract the motion of the user. But there's another method as well, and this was more popular a couple of years ago, and if you're in the market for a used camera, you might run across this. There might be some cameras nowadays that also try to do this, but mostly now we see it in the lens. But this other method is that they will actually move the sensor itself. So rather than actually moving the lens, where there's some object in the lens that's going to move around and try to counteract these actions, it's the sensor in the camera itself. And this actually has the advantage that all lenses that you attach to that camera will have optical image stabilization, because you can counteract for any lens that's attached to it, you can counteract the motion. The downside is that the image stabilization in a body is just not going to be as good. It's not going to be as fine-tuned. When they put it in a lens, they can fine-tune the stabilization for that lens, for that focal length, for whatever apertures, or for the specific the glass elements that they have within it. So it can be finely tuned to that specific lens, and you can be guaranteed that you will get a good result out of that. When we have to generalize it and put it in the body of the camera itself, we actually see that it degrades in performance as the lens, I think as the lens gets longer, it actually doesn't work quite as well. Might be the opposite. It's one of the two directions, I forget offhand, but still, in some direction, as the focal length gets larger or smaller, it just stops becoming quite as effective. Of course, you have to weigh this with the fact that having it built into the camera might make the camera a little bit more expensive, but all of a sudden, the lenses are cheaper, because every time you buy a lens with image stabilization, you are buying that technology over and over and over again. So if you have two lenses with it, you effectively bought that technology twice. Right, because the lenses that come with image stabilization are more expensive than their non-image stabilized cousins. And so as a result, if you buy two or three lenses or so with image stabilization, it's going to be more expensive to have a whole kit full of lenses with image stabilization that are in the lens rather than in the body itself. Now, one thing that might seem kind of minor, but I actually think is kind of a neat side effect of having the image stabilization in the lens, is that you will actually see the image stabilization occur if it's happening in the lens. And the reason for that is that in an SLR, anything that comes through the lens gets reflected up through the mirror, through the pentaprism, and to your eye. So you actually get to see the result of the optical image stabilization. And this can be kind of neat. You get a better sense of what the lens is doing, what the scene actually looks like. And the first couple times you use it, it can actually be a little bit unnerving, because you see it's kind of shaky, and you think it's you're doing a pretty good job holding it. But as soon as you turn on the image stabilization, everything just gets really smooth. And it just looks really sort of neat, I think, and a good way of helping you get your the shot that you intend. Now, many, regardless of where the image stabilization takes place, whether it's in the lens or in the camera, you should be careful when you have it enabled. Namely, when you have it enabled and connected to a tripod, you might actually get some unusual results. Not all image stabilization technologies can actually handle the case where it is attached to a tripod and it is actually very still. Sometimes they don't detect this very well and will continue trying to stabilize the movement when there is none, and so you'll actually get a blurry picture when it's on a tripod. So sometimes, and you'll have to look to see if your lens or if your camera supports this function, you'll have to see if it will kill the image stabilization when it notices that there's no movement. If not, be sure to turn it off yourself. Otherwise, you will get a blurry picture as you try to take a photo on a tripod. Now, one more thing about image stabilization is that there's actually multiple modes. Some of them actually allow image stabilization in not just both axes, but one or the other. And this can be useful if you were taking photos, like if you recall that one with the car that was zooming by, and it was taken during a race, and it looked relatively stabilized. And I still used image stabilization for that, but I only did it in the vertical direction. So in other words, if I was vibrating the lens up and down, it was correcting for that, but not in the horizontal direction because I was panning across. And so some of these image stabilization implementations actually have different mode buttons where you can enable full image stabilization across, you know, left and right and up and down, or just a panning stabilization where it will only be enabled for one of the two axes. Did you have a question? Okay. Now, of course, with this in mind, you can still get motion blur with image stabilization. Don't be surprised if you still do get it, especially if your subject is moving. You should. It's really only going to counteract your own motion, not the motion of anything that's in the scene. That's really important to remember. And many times you'll see people arguing, well, it doesn't stop time. It can't break the laws of physics. And that's usually what they're referring to, where it just cannot stop. It doesn't cause the shutter speed to be faster. It just effectively means that you can hold the shutter speed open for a longer amount of time and still get a sharp image. Now, typically you'll see image stabilization in longer lenses or in some of the less expensive lenses that have a smaller aperture, or they have a maximum aperture that maybe starts at about 5.6 or something like that, just because they're not letting in as much light, and they will implement as sort of a compromise, they'll implement this technology to try to combat that. But there's other types of lenses as well, and we have to switch gears just a little bit here. So instead of just having image stabilized lenses, and this we could consider it to be sort of a special class of lenses because not all lenses actually have this, there's yet a more specialized class of lens, and it's actually pretty rare these days, but it's called a tilt shift lens. And you might have actually seen this effect at some point before, where you actually get this really strange, very narrow depth of field in shots that you would expect to have very large depth of field, like this shot that is actually, it's not actually a model as much as it may seem. It is actually a scene of a highway in real life, but what makes it look like a model is that we are used to seeing photos of very small objects having a very, very narrow depth of field, so that the out-of-focus areas come very, very quickly in these types of pictures. But using a tilt-shift lens, we can essentially cause this effect to happen. Now, one of the other neat things about tilt-shift lenses is that there is another aspect of it as well, and that is that it can try to, or it can help combat this merging lines problems. If you take architecture photography and you are standing relatively close to, or even relatively far from a big building, you try to take a picture of the whole building, what ends up happening, of course, is that you have to point the camera up slightly. And with that, you get these converging lines of the building as you're pointing the camera up towards the sky. So like these examples that you see up top, where you actually have, you know, you're taking a picture from the ground, you're pointing up towards the building, so you can see the building is getting narrower. But in architecture photography, this may not be what you want. You may want the lines to actually be straight, so you get a good idea of what the building actually looks like, what its lines actually look like, and you can use the shift feature of a tilt-shift lens to do this. And I realize that this sounds counterintuitive, that you'd use shift for something that looks tilted, but I will explain why in just a moment. So let's say that we have a camera where we are trying to take a photo of a building, and we're standing relatively close to it, we're pointing up at it, and we take that photo. Now, assume for a moment that we do something where we won't get those converging lines. What do we have to do? We have to typically take a few steps back, point the camera completely level towards the ground, and take another photo, and try to do it so that we can actually get the entire building in that photo. And that's certainly fine, but the problem with that is that you get half of the ground, or half of your image is of the ground as well. This does solve the problem of the converging lines, but it doesn't. But it presents another problem to us, and that is that we're wasting half of our frame that we're trying to use for taking a photo of this building. So the reason that we would shift this is that what if there is a way that we could actually shift the horizon down like this? So we're still pointing it at the ground, but if we shift the horizon down, all of a sudden we have more leeway to work with a tall building. And that is precisely the type of shift that this represents. We shift the horizon, or we basically shift the axis of the lens off of the center a little bit, And what this causes is that the horizon is now down a bit, and we can take a photo of this building. And again, we have to point it squarely, we have to squarely aim it at the building, completely level without any converging lines. But we can get a little bit closer to this building again, because now we can use our entire frame to fill in this, to fill it in with our building. So the difference is that it's not that we're trying to tilt the image, and I don't want you to get confused by this tilt shift lens, and you use the tilt to try to tilt the image. What you are doing is you are shifting the horizon, which allows you to keep your camera aimed straight and get a little bit closer to your building so that you can get the entire building within your frame. So how does this actually work? Well, in a shift portion of the shift lens, it will actually move the optics relative to the frame a certain number of millimeters. And so you will actually see there's a little knob on these tilt shift lenses, and as you twist it, the lens will actually move up or down or side to side. And that's precisely what it's doing, is that it's shifting all of the optics in some particular direction. And because the image circle, because normally when a lens projects an image onto the sensor, it's just large enough to cover the sensor. But these tilt shift lenses have a much bigger circle so that there's leeway for it to shift up or down or left or right or all any combination of these for us to be able to use this exact feature. Now, if this is shift, then you might presume that this other technique where we're able to modify the depth of field by a certain amount would actually be used with tilt. And that's exactly what is going on. So with tilt, you're actually tilting the lens with respect to the sensor itself. So if we have a sensor or a typical lens-sensor combination, we would see that we have a lens that projects an image onto the sensor, and everything's 90 degrees and square and very nice. But we can actually tilt the lens itself. And this diagram I know shows it's tilting the sensor, but it's difficult to fit both on there if I tilt the lens. So if you tilt the lens down slightly, for example, what happens is that we have these rays that can converge at different points. So we can actually alter the depth of field by a certain amount. So if we look at the top image, for example, if we have two points of light at the top and at the bottom of the image, and they are both about the same distance away from the lens, that means that when we focus those rays of light onto the sensor, they will both be in focus. Now, if we actually tilt this lens, what can happen is that one of them might be in focus, but now all of a sudden the other one will not be. We can actually change the depth of the plane of the depth of focus. So typically what we see is that the depth of focus plane is parallel to our sensor. So in other words, when we take a photo of something that is 4 feet away and that's in focus, that means that everything that's 4 feet away from the camera will be in focus. But if instead we use this tilt option, we can actually tilt the plane, the depth of field plane, to look like this. So now we can actually get something that much more resembles, that would be much flatter. So you could use this very thing, for example, to get maybe an entire landscape in focus while using a relatively high or relatively low f-number, relatively large aperture, because you can tilt the plane of depth of focus so that you can get pretty much all of it in focus. So the difference then is that with tilt, you can actually make the depth of focus appear to be narrower or wider depending on how you tilt the specific or how you tilt the lens, or you can also use the shift to try to allow you to capture things that are off axis on your camera. So things like large buildings that you don't want to get any converging lines. Now, there's one more thing that I want to mention with regard to lenses, and that is that we can typically have filters in front of a lens. And recall that we talked about the filter symbol that is found on many lenses, and that is that it's this circle. It's basically the prohibition sign, the no symbol. So if you have a circle with a slanted line through it, that represents the filter size. So in the case of this image here, we can see that this lens has a filter size of 67 millimeters. Now, there's a whole bunch of filters available, and there's a whole bunch of different reasons why you might want to use a filter. But some of the most common ones are things like neutral density. And neutral density filters are effectively like sunglasses for your camera, where they block the amount of light that come in, but they do it in a neutral way. So in other words, they block the amount of red coming into your camera the same amount as they block the amount of green, the same amount as they block the amount of blue, so on and so forth. It's a neutral. It doesn't have any color cast to it. And it's important to realize that this is distinct from actual sunglasses, where you can actually get a bit of a color cast. Even if they're gray glasses, you can actually get a bit of a color cast as a result from them. So neutral density filters makes it darker for your camera. So in essence, you can have a longer shutter speed to capture something like this, where if you want to try to make your to make water a little bit smoother, you want to use a longer shutter speed. So you want to put on some sunglasses, so to speak, or to use a neutral density filter to try to make this happen. Now, one more filter that's actually pretty interesting is a polarizing filter. And a polarizing filter, if you're familiar with, some fancy sunglasses have polarizing coatings on them. What it actually does is blocks light in certain orientations. And what this effectively does is increases the contrast of a scene. So I took two photos here of the Charles River, one without a polarizing filter and one with. So you can see the difference between not having a polarizing filter and having one. And because, and you can see that it actually increased the contrast quite a bit, not only of the colors, but now there's more clouds apparent in the sky. It's just an interesting thing that you can apply. You can, of course, do this in software once you've downloaded the image to your computer, but using a polarizing filter gives you that sort of pop to begin with. Now, one of the side benefits of having a polarizing filter is you can use it to actually cut through reflections, because reflected light will become polarized. You can actually use a polarizing filter to cancel out that reflected light. So you can see here that we have two photos, and again, it's this of the same scene, one with the polarizing filter in a certain direction so that we can actually see the light that's being reflected off of the water, and another that blocks out that polarized light, the light that's being reflected off of the water. So in essence, what we see is what is underneath the water. So we can actually cut through reflections using polarized lenses. So this could be useful if you're taking photos of water and you want to see what's underneath it, or you want to perhaps enhance the reflections of the water. It could also be useful if you're taking pictures of glass, for example, any sort of glass photo, so maybe a car, for example. You might also benefit from using the same sort of filter. Now, one more type of filter I suppose I should mention very quickly is this haze UV filter. Those actually don't seem to... those are claimed to cut down on the amount of UV light that enters into your lens. And what they say is that this should therefore reduce the amount of haze that's visible in a scene that you take with one of these UV filters. Frankly, I'm not sure. I've used some of these filters and I'm not sure that I've seen that. So what people like to do is use these UV filters as protection on the front of their lens. They say that, okay, there's an extra piece of glass between the outside world and my lens. So if this part breaks, maybe it's bumped and it cracks or something like that, then I can replace that filter much more cheaply than I can replace the lens itself. And that might be a fair argument, but I would counter and say that any additional glass that you put in front of the lens is going to reduce the amount of light entering it. It doesn't matter how many coatings you have on a filter, but it is going to reflect some light off of it. And some of that light means that you are losing light that can enter into the lens. And so while it may be relatively minuscule, like maybe a third of a stop or something like that, it is still a measurable amount of light. So you have to figure out how risk averse you are. If you want to be paranoid about your lenses, this might be a good way of protecting them, at least the front elements, is you can use that as a protective means against the environment. But if you really if you want to have the fastest lens that you can and make sure that you reduce the reflections, because every piece of glass you add, you increase the risk for reflections between two pieces of glass inside of the lens, then I would say that it's probably fine to skip it. I haven't used haze UV filters on my lenses ever, and it's been perfectly fine. So with that said, again, you know, we finished last week's lecture, yay, and we can move on finally to today's, the histogram. Now, the histogram you guys have probably all seen and played with, But even those of you who might understand what's going on or what it represents, I'm sure will still learn something from today's lecture. And that is because there is a lot more data that is shown to you in a histogram than you might think. And that is given to you by the fact that we have an entire lecture devoted to the histogram. This is actually can be a relatively deep subject, and I think it's one that's worth talking about, especially now that we have the histogram tools available to us, not only in cameras, but also in software. So before we talk about what a histogram is in terms of digital photography, it's useful to talk about what a histogram is in general. A histogram is actually just a generic term for a type of graph that looks like this. All it does is it counts things. It tells you how frequently something occurs in whatever the context is. So this is just a generic histogram that tells you the heights of black cherry trees. So in other words, we have a range of cherry trees that, or we have a whole bunch of cherry trees that range in height from 60 to 90 feet in height, and we wanted to count them to see what the distribution of the heights of these cherry trees were. So we can see that on this axis, on the x-axis, we have what we are counting. These are the trees at the various heights. So we have trees at 60 feet, 65 feet, 70 feet, so on and so forth. And then on the other axis, on the y-axis, it's the frequency, or it's how many trees that number applies to. So we have 60. We can see that we have, we're between 2 and 4, so we actually have 3 trees that are 60 feet in height. Going on to the next one, 65, it's again 3 tall, so we have 3 trees that are 60 feet in height. Then 70, we can see there's a sharp jump to about 7. 75, we can see that's the majority of these trees, or what looks like the majority of these trees, is about 9 feet, and then it starts to taper off after that. And that's exactly what this is. It's showing you the frequency of something within the context. And if we are now to apply this to the idea of a digital camera, we can see that we might have something that looks like this. There's a lot more stuff going on, but it's still essentially the same thing. What this is telling you is the frequency, how many pixels you have as the image goes from dark or black all the way to white. So if you have a very high mountain, for example, on a histogram that's just over halfway through, then you can assume that this is sort of over, this is just over, you know, middle gray. This is just over middle gray, and you have a good number of pixels that adjust or that are within that range. So we are counting the number of occurrences of each of these particular things, and we're counting them in terms of pixels. So we can see in this photo that there's a fair amount of gray. There's not a lot of deep black, for example. There's very, very little deep black. There's very, very little bright white. We have a good amount of just sort of this middle gray. So we might be able to reasonably assume that this photo is, in fact, well exposed, because there's no pixels that have been so underexposed that they appear black. There's no pixels that appear so overexposed that they appear white. But as you'll see, this does not tell us the whole story. There is actually some you need some more data to actually be able to say whether or not an image is properly exposed just by the histogram. Okay, so we have here variances in gray. So we started with black, and then we get a dark gray, you know, to a lighter gray, to white, so on and so forth. We call this down here the tones, or how many the different tones that we have within an image. So the tones just refer to in speaking of black and white, how dark or how bright that image might be, or the tonal range of that particular image. Now, how do we go about creating one of these histograms? Now, it's important to realize that all we're doing is counting the number of pixels that exist within this within an image. So if we have an image that is totally, completely black, maybe it's completely underexposed, or you open up Photoshop, use the paint bucket tool, and you paint an image that is completely black, you're going to get an image that looks like, or you're going to get a histogram, rather, that looks like this, where it is a, you know, it's the rectangle that represents the histogram, but you have only one spike in the completely dark region, telling you that all of the pixels that are present within this image exist as black. So you can see that this big spike on the far left means that we have a completely dark image. Now, what about white? We can expect the opposite, where there is the one line at the very, very far right, that single pixel line, you see that black line? That line represents all of the white that exists within this image, and because it is completely present in this image, then that is what is going to be counted. So, if we want to take a look at histograms of some well-exposed photographs, for example, we could take a look at this one from this pinhole photo from last year, where it's actually, we can see that there's a good amount of range in here, but we have some predominantly dark regions and some, there's a little bit of lighter areas. And you can see that in the photo itself, how there's a good amount of dark area that's not completely black, and there is a good amount of light area that's not completely white, and that is represented here on the histogram. And so this really tells us the tonal range, or the range of tones that exist within this image. This tonal range isn't, you know, it doesn't extend very, very far. It's a good tonal range, but it's not ridiculous. It doesn't extend too far beyond the camera's capabilities. So that is something certainly to consider. So it's this, when we take a look at this, and this photo, and I can say, actually looks pretty bad on the projector. It looks a little too dark compared to what the image looks like on my screen. On my screen, it looks much less like this area, for example, is completely dark. There's actually, you can actually see that it's a bit of green. So this, I think, actually does a pretty good, is a pretty good example of why you should not rely on the LCD screen on the back of your camera to determine if an image is well exposed, because the lighting scenario will change. So if you are in a bright light region, for example, if you're outside and there's a lot of sun, the screen on your camera might be a bit washed out and you might actually lose some of the contrast. And if you're inside and it's completely dark, the screen might look too bright, and so you might then want to underexpose an image because you're trying to make it look right on the screen. But this is not a really good way of determining the exposure of your image. You really need to look at the histogram as well to try to determine. If I took this photo and I saw that the histogram was way over here to the left and I had a lot of pixels that were in this very dark region, then that's sort of a red flag to me that says, okay, perhaps this image is actually underexposed. It depends on the type of image, of course, but if I have an image that has tonal range that looks like this, which is, you know, really not that extreme of a range, then I would expect not to have to have a lot of pixels in either the very dark or very bright regions. So another example is this one here. The tonal range, you'll notice, is a bit wider in this case. There's more regions that are a lot brighter, completely white, and there's more regions that are nearly completely black. But this also shows that it's actually relatively properly exposed. There's not huge spikes on the far left or on the far right representing deeply underexposed or deeply overexposed areas. We can see that the tonal range fits relatively well within the histogram that we have here. So in combination with the context of the photo, that I know that I don't want to have any deeply underexposed or deeply overexposed regions, I can say, okay, this actually might be pretty good of a histogram, and it might be pretty good exposure for this image. Now, one question that might come up is, why are the heights as they are in each of these images? In other words, why does the histogram seem to be generally much higher in this image than it is in this image, where it just seems, you know, in general, the black region just seems to be a lot lower? And so it's important to realize that what the histogram is showing you is relative height. So the histogram only has this much width to give you its information and this much height to give you its information. And it has to show you all of the pixels, the information for all of the pixels in an image in this small box. Which means that if I have a region that is predominantly one tone, if I have an image that is predominantly one tone, I might have a very large single spike like this, and because it is predominantly this one tone, relatively all of the other tones are going to get pushed down in prominence. So relative to this one tone that is very, very prominent in this image, and again, the tone is not the color, there's not one specific color, but rather the apparent brightness of some particular portion of this image, because the apparent brightness of this particular image is so dominant compared to this brighter area, for example, everything else gets pushed down. But so when we see a histogram that looks like this, where everything is relatively high, then that means that the tonal range is actually pretty evenly distributed throughout the entire thing. There's no one area that is much more prominent in this photo than the others. And yes, it's true that this area is more prominent than this one, but not to the degree that this tone is to this one, if that distinction makes sense. So if you have something that is so, and this might even apply to, or this does even apply to under or overexposed images as well, if you have an image that is so heavily underexposed that most of the pixels are black, you're going to see a very large bump in the very left of the histogram, and everything else is going to appear to be very, very flat. And so you'll lose some of the ability to look at the, or you'll lose the sense of how much of the rest of the image is composed of the tonal range, just because it's all relative to that. So, moving on, there's one more. So what about if there's, so one question here. Is there anything that is pure white in this image? Yeah, there's a little tiny bit, just the tiniest blip is pure white pixels. And honestly, given the tonal range of this image, we could probably consider this to be well exposed, just because if I tried to account for that, if I called that an unacceptable amount of overexposure, and I then tried to underexpose by a third of a stop, I might get that to become not pure white, but then I will underexpose quite a large portion of this image as well. So it's okay to have just a little blip of black and bright regions, especially when you're presented with a scene that's like this, that has a larger range of darkness and bright, of dark and bright regions. But it's more risky to have larger blips on either end. Okay, so another example of a histogram that might be well exposed. Here we have an image that has a wide tonal range. And you can see that because there's regions that are very, very dark. There's regions that are very, very bright. So the very, very dark regions are over here, it's basically just this obscured rock that's, you know, almost silhouetted by the remaining light. And then the very center, where there's actually a light shining through the water, is a very bright region of the image. And you can actually see relative how much that big black area right there takes up in terms of the overall tonal range of this image. There's actually a pretty significant spike in this black area right here. And the rest of it, though, looks pretty good, and we do have a little bit of a spike in the white area. But again, given the difference in brightness, this is probably as good as we were going to get. Unless we had some other thing in mind where we actually wanted to get this in properly exposed, then we would have to increase the exposure compensation to get this area brighter, but at the expense of having this area become even brighter and even more washed out, which might not be what we intended. So I'm showing you all of these because there's no one histogram that makes it right. You can't look at a histogram by itself and determine from it whether or not an image is properly exposed. There are just too many other factors going on, especially if you have a large blip on the left side or on the right side. It could hint to you that there is a considerable amount of under or overexposure going on, but it doesn't tell you that that is necessarily incorrect. And to prove this to you, let's go back to this photo, where we actually have intentionally underexposed portions of the image. So we have a very dark region behind this bottle of whiskey, and that was intentional. We wanted this area to become underexposed, and we see that in the histogram. We have a lot of very, very dark pixels, and because the relative height to that is so overwhelming compared to this lighter area of pixels, we can see that it essentially pushes down the remaining, you know, mountain, so to speak, of those higher tonal range. So we have something that looks much more extreme, where we have some very, very dark regions in this image, and that is so prominent within this image that the area that is actually properly exposed seems underrepresented in the histogram. But it's still there, it just looks much less obvious, and it just looks much less important in the histogram than it did in the previous photos where the tonal range actually fit within the camera's capabilities. So at the opposite end, we have a big overexposure where we have, and this one, as you can see from the histogram, this actually did a better job, perhaps, of completely overexposing this image, because you can see that the spike on the far right is narrower, which means that these pixels that are on the far right are actually true white. They're all the way over there to the right, whereas on this one, we have sort of a wider mountain on this far left, which means that, yes, we have some pure black pixels, but we also have some that are not quite pure black. And you can actually see that, and again, it's difficult on this one, but if you look at these slides on the PDF version off the website, you can actually see that there is a little spot over here. There's a little spot of light that's right here that is actually reflected or refracted off of the bottle and shines onto the black pedestal, or the black t-shirt, frankly, that I had it sitting on. And it's not obvious from just looking at it, but you can see the histogram that there are obviously some pixels that are not pure black. And had I wanted to spend more time to try to correct this, using the histogram would have told me, okay, there are some regions that are not pure black. This would be a good time for me to look and find out where those are. Whereas this one, this was actually much more successful in terms of getting it completely overexposed, where you can see that spike on the far right is actually very, very narrow. There's not a lot of pixels that are not pure white in that sort of very bright region. And relative, though, to this other image, there's many more pixels that are represented by the tonal range, whereas, so you can see here that in this image, the bottle is slightly smaller, and even within the bottle itself, there's some dark regions here. So it just, there's just not, the tonal range is just sort of distributed throughout this entire range, whereas in this brighter one, we have some tonal range that is a bit spikier, where we can actually see some of the tones besides white that exists within it. Now, to show you that you can look at a histogram and it can look like it's correct, but you can actually be misled into thinking that it's right, I bring again this photo that's here. So this photo, what we had was this was the photo that we used as an example of exposure compensation. When you had to make the decision that you needed to tell the camera to overexpose from what it thought was the proper scene, and that was because when it tried to expose, or when it tried to meter the scene as a whole, it did it for middle gray. And as a result, because this scene is primarily snow, it makes everything just this sort of darker gray thing that we don't want. And so by giving it some additional exposure compensation, it becomes nearly white like we wanted. And had I relied only on the histogram, well, I guess knowing, you know, standing in the snow, knowing that it was snow, and seeing a histogram like this, this is a pretty good clue that this is underexposed. But if you looked not at the photo, but instead just at the histogram, it would be tough to say that this particular image was not exposed properly, was underexposed or overexposed or what have you, just because you don't have the context of what this scene actually is. So this very well could be properly exposed if the scene were different, if it's not of a snow scene, but because we know that the snow should be white, we can look at this histogram and say, okay, this is obviously underexposed, where this region, which probably applies to the snow because it's one of the brighter regions in this image, actually needs to be pushed up towards this right end of the histogram. So adding in the exposure compensation, we make it much brighter, and it pushes the entire histogram as a whole to the right as those tones become a bit brighter. Okay, so take 5 minutes to digest that. When we come back, we'll continue talking about histograms. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. So before the break, we were talking about histograms and how we can use the histogram to sort of get a sense for how properly exposed an image is. And so having both knowledge of what the image itself is and the histogram itself is a very useful tool in combination because you can know if the camera has taken something that is perhaps under or overexposed, especially as in the case here, where we can actually take a look at this scene, and we can say, okay, well, I know that this is a snow scene, and if I look at the histogram of the photo that was taken, I can see that most of these tones are darker, so I probably have to add some exposure compensation. And actually, this would have been really useful, because when I took this first photo, I took the photo and I walked off. And then later did I check the histogram, and I realized that because it was relatively bright outside, it was relatively dark outside, rather, and because of that, I didn't notice it looked bright enough on the camera's screen, and so I just left without actually reviewing the histogram, and I had to come back at a later point, and I might as well not have, it's not that interesting of a photo, but I had to come back just to take this photo that is now overexposed slightly, or at least overexposed in terms of what the camera thinks it should have been the proper exposure. Now, you can especially see some exposure problems in histograms that are, just very much inverted. So rather than having histograms that are, very mountainous in the center where we have all the tones in the center of the image, we can sometimes have this inversion where suddenly all of a sudden all of the peaks are all the way at the outside, the very dark region, very bright, and the very bright region. And this is an immediate red flag for pretty much every photo where you can say, okay, there's probably something going on with the exposure in this photo. But this is perhaps the only time, and even then, there's exceptions, but this is perhaps the only time where you can look at a histogram and say that this image is going to have some problems, just because you know that there's going to be a lot of really dark areas and a lot of really bright areas, and it's just difficult to get an image that there's not as many occasions where an image that has a histogram that looks like this will appear to have a correct exposure. So, this is pretty easy, right? It's not too bad. And you would think that, oh man, we're early, we can pack up, we can go home. But the problem is that the devil, of course, is in the details. There's details in all of this that make this a little bit trickier, but also a lot more interesting and perhaps a lot more useful. Now, it's important for me to mention early on that what these histograms are showing you is something called luminance, or the apparent brightness of an image. And that makes perfect sense, I think, for a lot of these images, because this we can see some of these regions and they appear to be, very dark, and then up there the region appears to be very bright. But there are actually different types of histograms that we can actually measure. And before we can talk about these different types, though, we have to go back to a little bit of a refresher about about what it is that a computer uses to store some of this information. So the first lecture, one of the things I talked about were bits and bytes. And I said in the very first lecture that computers, of course, store images in according to ones and zeros. So all of these images are stored as zeros and ones, and we can call a collective 8 bits as 1 byte. And this is very typical. This is just sort of what this is very typical computer speak, that we would say a bit is a zero or a one. It's either on or off. We could say, or rather, off and on, however you want to consider it. And a byte is 8 of these bits in a row. And we mentioned that if we have 1 byte of information, that means that we can have how many different discrete values? How many values can a byte represent? So if there's 8 bits, that means that it's 0 or 1, so there's 2 different values, times 2, times 2, times 2, times 2, so 2 to the 8th power. So how many different values can we have in 1 byte of information? Any ideas? 256, that's right. So we can have 256 different values. So we could have 1, 2, 3, 4, dot, 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 all the way up to 256. Now, there's a small detail, of course. When we're talking about computers, computers start counting at 0. So when we are looking at 1 byte of information, the range of values goes from 0 to 255. This is still 256 discrete values. It's just that rather than counting 1 to 256, we're counting 0 to 255. Okay, so that's just a small distinction. But what we are doing is we are applying all of this, or we are using the histogram to show us all of these different values. And you might recall that we can use this byte of information to represent a brightness, where 0 is completely black. It's the complete absence of light. And 255 is white. It's the complete presence of light. And this is exactly what's happening. So if we have any values in this furthest left pixel, this represents a pixel that has a brightness value of 0, which means that there is no brightness in it at all. It's completely black. Okay, so 0 is black. That's hopefully pretty easy to remember. And at the opposite spectrum is white, the maximum value that is allowed to us by this byte, or the value 255. Now, you'll notice that this is not actually measuring color. This is a gray scale. This goes from black, all of the gray tones in between, to white. And there's complete black at 0, complete white at 255, and all of the variations of gray going from 1 to 254. All of these things are accounted for in this histogram. But what we are not counting again is color. Color is not present in this particular histogram. And again, what I'm talking about is this luminance histogram, or this brightness. So what appears to be bright in this image, if it's completely black or completely white? Okay, keep that in mind. That is definitely very important. When we're talking about JPEG, though, we talked about these different file formats that exist, and we said that each of these file formats can have a different number of bits or bytes to represent one pixel. And a JPEG, for example, will have 24 bits of information total, or 3 bytes, 1 byte for every major color in a computer system. So we break down a color into its red component, its green component, and its blue component, and we give it 1 byte of information for each. So what this means is that we can have, in combination, a range of all of these colors. So we can have, for example, for the red color in this one pixel, it could be a 0, or it could be a 255, or it could be anything in between, where 0, again, is the complete absence of that color. It is completely black. And 255 is the complete presence of this color. So if we have a pixel, and it has, the 3 bytes of information, the red byte has a value of 255, the green byte has a value of 0, and the blue byte has a value of 0, what color is that pixel? Red, right? Because red is completely present in that pixel, and no other values are present. Green is not present, blue is not present. Now, green and blue also follow this same pattern, where we can have 0 be a value for green, or 255, or any number in between, and that tells you how much green there is, whether it be completely black or some lighter shade all the way up to this very bright green. And blue, the same thing, 0 all the way to 255. And so we can combine a number of these. So let's say I wanted to do this. Let's say I had 0 for the red byte, 255 for the green byte, and 255 for the blue byte. What color would I be making? So this blue-green, it'd be a mixture of blue and green, so yellow's close, but it's actually cyan. So if we wanted to make yellow, what we would have to do is red and green. So 255, 255, and 0 will make yellow. And we can make the last major combination here would be like a violet. So what we would do then is 255 for red, 0 for green, and 255 for blue. We would get this violet color from this. And so all of the colors that you see because of your digital camera or on your computer screen are a result of these 3 pieces of information. 3 bytes represent 1 color for every single pixel. So, and it may not seem like very much. It may seem like, gosh, it really doesn't seem like very many variations in color. But if you multiply 255 times 255 times 255, you see that you actually get a lot of colors. It's probably like, 16 million different variations of color? Because you could have, 13 for red and 150 for green and 0 for blue. And there's any number of combinations. There's many, many colors. Pretty much all of the colors that we can see, that we can appreciate, not literally so, but nearly all of the colors that we can see can be represented with this idea that's right here. Okay, so we have this obvious problem where the colors, or rather the photos that we take, are in color, and each of the pixels is made up of these 3 bytes of information, a red byte, a green byte, and a blue byte. So we have color in these images. But as you have seen, the histograms don't show us anything about color, but instead the brightness. Is there a question?
Yeah,
So when red has a value of 0, that means that there is no red in that pixel at all. So if we wanted to make a pixel black, that means that there has to be the complete absence of all of these colors. So red would have to be 0, green would have to be 0, and blue would have to be 0. So rather than what I'm showing is black here is meant to be taken as the absence of this color. So if we wanted to have just a blue pixel, for example, that blue pixel can't have any red in it. That blue pixel can't have any green in it, so these two values will be 0, and the red portion, or the blue portion rather, will be 255.
And how does black come in here?
So if we wanted to make a black pixel again, then that means that all we need to do is have all zeros. So no red, no green, no blue. The computer realizes that this is the complete absence of all color, so it's just going to be black. The opposite, if we wanted to make white, the opposite would be true, where we have the complete presence of all of these. 255, 255, and 255 would represent a completely white pixel.
Oh, so it's kind of like it is told what it would represent. It's not really a mix of red with green. It's not really a color mixing. It's really like you decided. It's a programming.
Right, it's the program. Well, all of these values are for one pixel. So if you want to mix colors, then you can have multiple values. So you could have, like, if you had 255 for red and 255 for blue, for example, and 0 for green, that means that at that pixel there will be all red and all blue but no green, so you would get a purple pixel. So you combine these three pieces of data for one pixel to get the different colors that can exist. And all of these are considered separate until they are mixed to show you, if that makes sense. So they're only mixed when the computer is actually trying to show you a color, does it actually say, okay, these values in combination will produce this color. Well, that doesn't actually say that, but you know, in essence, that's what is happening. So we have these three pieces of information for a pixel that in combination make up some color. But the histograms that we've seen are all represented in terms of luminance, or how bright that pixel appears to be. So we have this problem. How do we make each of these, or how do we bring down these three pieces of information to just one grayscale color? And recall that one of the things that I had said was that our histograms count data from 0 to 255, and we have three of these things that are 0 to 255. So what might be a reasonable thing for us to do? What would be a reasonable way for us to try to figure out to get one value out of these three? Yeah. I'm sorry?
Just total the numbers?
Yeah, so we would total them and maybe divide by 3 to just get an average. So we could get an average of these colors. We would add up whatever is combined of these three and to figure out what gray that actually represents. Now, this would be reasonable, right? This might be a reasonable thing for us to do, but it would in fact not be representative of the brightness of that pixel. And again, the devil is in the details. The reason that that is true goes back to what we talked about a long time ago with the eye. Remember that I had said that we have rods and cones. The cones are primarily responsible for giving us color vision in the eye. But even though we have three different types of cones, we have far more of the M and the L types of cones than we do the S type, which means that we are more sensitive to green and to red than we are to blue. And for that reason, I want you to imagine something. And this is going to be a little weird at first, but it is going to work if you listen to my instructions. That is to close your eyes. And no, I'm not going to hypnotize you or do anything scary, but just close your eyes for a minute and imagine that you have three different rooms. One room, you have a light that is only red. Another room, you have a light that is only green. And the third room, you have a light that is only blue. There's no other color in any of these rooms. Now, which of these rooms would appear to be brightest to you? Which ones in your mind do you think would look brightest? Green. And it is, in fact, the green. So if we take a look at this, when we look at these three colors, these represent the different values. So what I did with this red block was I gave that red byte, you know, it was 255 for red, 0 and 0 for the other two. So 0 green, 0 blue. There's no green, no blue in this red. And similarly, in this green, there's no red and there's no blue. And in this blue, there's no green, there's no blue, there, you know, there's no other color associated with that. And if we actually convert this to a grayscale of how our eye actually perceives this, the average person perceives the brightness of each of these colors like this, where the green and the red are much brighter than the blue. And this may not have been obvious to you, but it's just because we're used to seeing blue like this. But this blue, technically, or in absolute terms, is as bright as the rest. But because of the way that our cones are because of the count of cones that we have in our eyes, we actually do not perceive blue to be as bright as the rest. So in terms of what is actually important for human perception of brightness, green is the most important. Green is how we perceive the majority of the brightness in a scene or in a photo. So all of these have, you know, they're unequal quantities of intensities. And as a result, we can actually put a sort of a mathematical equation behind this. We can actually say that green, in terms of how bright something is, green is actually about 60% of what makes up the brightness, or about 0.59. Red is half that, at about 0.3%, and blue trails way behind at 11%. And now in combination, all of these make up the brightness. So so what's going on with this particular equation is that we can take those three values from the color information. So let's say that we had a completely red pixel, for example, and we wanted to figure out how bright that is to our eyes, to our human eyes, in, you know, for the average perception of a person. What we would do is we would say, okay, 0.3 times 255 is some number, plus 0 for green and 0 for blue. So what this essentially means is that the luminance of that particular pixel is at about 30%. It's not completely bright, it's not completely dark, but instead it is this sort of darkish, but not very dark, this darkish gray. And hopefully this actually looks kind of close. And what this is meant to show you is the actual relative intensities of these colors to our eyes, where blue just does not look as bright to us as green does. And going with this exact luminance calculation, that is how you can actually determine the brightness of each of these values, or of each of these colors. So we can use this, and this is actually what happens, what your camera uses to determine the luminance histogram. So what does this mean? Well, that means that if I have a picture, and that picture is completely red, there is no other pixels that are, or there's no pixels that are any other colors, there's no hint of green or of blue, then that means that my histogram will have a spike at about 30%. And that's because, that when we look at that image, it only looks to be about 30% as bright as what it actually could be. So this image, for example, appears to us, and of course it's not, we wouldn't think of it explicitly as being only 30%, but due to a lot of research that some smart people have done, they've actually determined that red, completely red, actually appears to us in relative terms as being 30% as bright as this same thing would be if it were all white. So this histogram then looks like this. It's not all the way up at the upper right. It's not all the way up at the lower left. It just is right there at about 30%. If we change this to be green, what would it look like instead? Yeah, it's about 60%. So about 2/3 of the way over, we would have a spike that's right here. And blue, since it's 11%, we would have a spike that's way over here at the left. Now, look at some of this data that Photoshop actually gives us. This is a screenshot of the histogram, of a luminance histogram in Photoshop. And you can see that it's a luminance histogram because the channel at the top says luminosity. So what it is measuring is the apparent brightness of this image. And as you can see, it's a drop-down. There's other options. We'll talk about those in just a moment. But for now, luminosity is generally what you would find in a camera, generally. So you'll notice that we have it at about 30%. You'll see that the mean value of this is 76. And how or why is it 76? Well, that is just because it is 255 times 0.3. In other words, they took this equation. They realized that it's completely red, so it's 0.3 times 255 plus 0.59 times 0 because there's no green, plus 0.11 times 0 because there's no blue. So 0.3 times 255 is, in fact, 76. And if you don't believe me, you can bust out with your cell phone calculators. It will actually be true. It is 76, and so that is what it is showing us here. And we can actually see the number of pixels that's happening here. So we have about 40,000 pixels in this image, and all of them are this level at 76. So at level 76, we have a count of 40,000, and it is the 100th percentile. It is what makes up the majority of this image. And so you can see it a little better. I will zoom in. So you can see all of this data that I was just talking about. The number of pixels, the mean value of this image, which 76 is, you know, it goes on that scale from 0 all the way to 255, recall, but this scale is a gray scale, which means that 0 is black, 255 is white, and everything in between is just this relative brightness, dark, you know, relative gray, amount of gray in this image, but it has been calculated by using this thing. So you can see that we can actually create a histogram based on this color. And in fact, there's a person that actually had this pretty neat idea to take an image and try to make a histogram out of it. So in other words, he did the opposite of what most of us would consider, where you have an image and you look at the histogram. Instead, imagine that we have this. There is this image here, and you'll notice that it is composed of varying levels of black to white. And if we look at the histogram of this image, the histogram actually has an image built in, which is, of course, the skyline of New York, or was the skyline of New York. But what is interesting about this is that this, he made this just by using relative differences in counts. So you can see that there's quite a few of these dark pixels, for example, and you can actually see that up here. So if we were to actually break apart all of these pixels and actually count them, which ones are at each of these different values from 0 to 255, we would see that the count of all of those looks like this. And of course, you don't have to do anything like this. It's just sort of a neat way of taking advantage of the way a histogram is generated to make sort of a neat image from it. Okay, now back to this. We can actually generate our own histogram as well. So if we had an image that looks like this, and we wanted to create a histogram out of it, how would we do that? Well, we first have to take a look at what is the majority, or we have to take a look at what might be the tallest spikes. So we have different color blocks within this image. Which of these color blocks will have the tallest spikes? The red, the green, and the blue, that's correct. And how much taller will they be compared to these smaller bars of color? They will be larger, but how much larger? Right, two times as large. And that is true because there is twice as much of this color bar, for example, than there is this color bar. So what we will see is that there is, because we're counting the number of pixels, we would count twice as many of these pixels as we would count in this color bar here. So we would expect to have a color bar that is twice as high for the solid red, solid green, and solid blue as we would for the white, the yellow, the black, and the cyan. So if we actually wanted to be a computer ourselves and generate a histogram that looks like this, let's get started. So recalling that we said that these solid or these primary colors, so-called primary colors in terms of computer speak, are the largest, we'll start with these. So if we are going to generate a luminance histogram with this, we are going to take this red bar, and about how bright is it? Remember, in terms of the luminance calculation, where on this histogram scale should it be located? Right, so about 30% of the way over. So about a third of the way over, we should see a bar. And we've already talked about the height. The height should be twice as large as these smaller ones. And because it's the highest bar, we will go ahead and make that extended all the way up to the top. Okay, we'll just call this sort of the maximum for this particular image. So we've done red. That's not too bad. What about green? So where will this be in this direction? How far over to the right will we expect this green? So about two-thirds, about 59% technically, but about two-thirds is close enough for our purposes. And it will again be because it is also twice as high, and because we have the same amount of green as we have red, they will be the same height. So we would have this, we have a histogram that looks sort of like this. And again, it's not that I'm trying to divide this into thirds, it's just that this is how this histogram is appearing to us. Now what about blue? How far over does this appear? Right, so to the left of this red line, and maybe at about 10 or 11%, so maybe about there. So something like this. Okay, so now we have a little bit more work cut out for us with these smaller ones. We've done the easy ones to begin with, but what about these smaller ones? Let's start with white. Now, if we have white, recall that that is made up, the color white is made up by the value 255 for red, 255 for green, 255 for blue. So we can do, we could actually go all the way back to this and multiply, okay, 255 times 0.3 is 76, plus 255 times 0.6 is 160 something, and 255 times 0.11 is, you know, 25. You add up all that together, you actually get 255. The reason for that is that white is completely bright. It has all of those, it has all of the presence of all of those colors there, so it is going to be completely bright. So we expect that to be all the way to the right. Right? Okay. So how tall should this bar be? Halfway up. Yep. So we have a bar that's like this. And again, this should be all the way to the right. Don't, you know, ignore my little spacing issue there. So all the way to the right, and it's about halfway up. Now what about black? Black is pretty easy. It's the complete absence of all of these. So 0.3 times 0 plus 0.59 times 0 times 0.11 times 0. It's just zero. It's the complete absence. There's no brightness in this, so we expect to have a half-height bar all the way to the left. Right? All right. Now we got the second most easy ones out of the way. Now we have two left, the yellow and the cyan. So if we take a look at the yellow first, recall that this was made up by combining two colors. We said that we would combine which two colors to get yellow? Red and green. So that means that we have 255 for red, 255 for green, and 0 for blue. Now, if we wanted to figure out at what percentage this is actually going to take place, we would have to use this again, where it's 0.3 times 255 is, you know, 76 plus 0.59 times 255 is, I don't know, 150-something plus 0 for blue. We add all of that up together, and we actually get the value 227. So you could do this in a calculator, but I have it pre-computed. So it's 227 out of 255, which means that it is actually going to be something, I don't know, like that's going to be, what did I say? 90%, so something like this right here. So we would expect this bar right here to be for the yellow. I suppose I should label all of these. This was the blue. This was the red. This was the green. Blue and yellow and white. Okay, now we have one left, this cyan, which is a combination of which two colors? Blue and green. So 0 for red, 255 for green, and 255 for blue, which means that we are essentially going to be adding, you know, go back to this thing again, 0.59 times 255 is like 150-something, plus 0.1 times 255 is like 25. So what we are going to get is a value of about 178. And 178 is less than the yellow, but more than the green, so we would expect this cyan to be here. No, I did this wrong. This is cyan, so it is blue and green. Okay, blue and green. Now, we've actually created our own histogram based on the colors that are shown in this image. And if we take a look at the actual histogram that is produced by Photoshop, we can see that it matches exactly with our calculations. Right? Okay, good. Yes?
Would you just have to know those color combinations? Because if you mix paint colors, if you mix green paint with red paint, it won't be yellow. Is it just the white? So
that's a good question. So how do you get this color intellectually? So if you don't actually know how to mix these colors together, how can you do it? There's a variety of ways. You can find probably some tools online, but there's also tools available in Photoshop, for example, where you can actually try to mix and match your own colors. So you'll notice that there's a whole bunch of stuff here. Ignore all of this stuff except these three. There's a red, a green, and a blue section. We can type those values, 0 to 255, in here, and it will show us the matching result. So if I type in all zeros in red, in green, and in blue, we see that it has selected black down here, and you can see that color also up here. I'll zoom in a little bit to try to make this a little bit easier to see. Now, instead, if I had 255 and 0 and 0, you see that what it has selected is all red up there. And if I add now 255 for blue, we get this bright purple, this violet color. So if you actually want to figure out what color combinations you would use to get a particular color, you would use something like this. So we can see that there's a whole rainbow of colors here. If I wanted to figure out which one is cyan, I would use my mouse to click on what looks like cyan, and you can see we've gotten pretty close. 255 for green, 255 for blue, and 0 for red will give us that cyan color. And we can make any of these color combinations by just clicking on them, by typing in what we will perceive to be their values, or clicking on them. We can see that to get an orange, we would get like 250, we would put in 255 for red and only half green, so about 138 or 127 or something around that, to get an orange-like color. Any number of these colors can be produced by modifying this color information right here. So using a tool like Photoshop, or even, frankly, Microsoft Word typically has tools like this. If you want to change the text color, for example, you'll find something that looks sort of similar to this, not exactly. You might not actually get the raw values, RGB values, but you will be able to mix colors together and see the result of mixing these three colors. And you can also probably find tools online to help you do the same sort of thing, figuring out what colors are represented by what combinations of red, green, and blue. Hopefully, makes sense so far. Any other questions on this? Okay. Now, this is the graph that's produced by, or the luminance histogram that is produced by Photoshop, and it matches what we created. You can see it shows you some of the information, like the average brightness of this, which is about 116.90. So on average, if you were to look at this, it's just shy of half bright. So it's pretty close to, you know, middle gray, so to speak. Standard deviations, there's just a whole bunch of stuff that's available there for us to take a look at. Now, there are more histograms, of course, than just luminosity. Now, before we talked about some of these, though, it's important to realize that photos are obviously not made up of TV color bars like this. Like, yes, you could actually determine the luminosity for every single pixel in your image and create a histogram by yourself, but it will take you forever because there's so many different color combinations in all of these images that it will just take you an age to try to calculate the histogram of an image by yourself. Now, a computer can do this much more quickly, of course, but we use that simple colored bars diagram just as a way to make you more comfortable with how a computer is actually computing this. But of course, our images don't look like that. Our images will be much more complex. Even something that looks like this, where we have a gradient, or we have a smooth change of color from red all the way up to white. So if we had this as our photo, we would have a luminance histogram that looks like that in the upper right. And that actually makes a bit of sense, right? Because we have pixels that are completely red, and they get brighter and brighter and brighter until they eventually become completely white. So we have no pixels in this image that are darker than all red. So we have in our luminance histogram a range from about 30% all the way to the top. Now, a common question that comes up in something like this is, why is it that the histogram appears to be kind of spiky like this? And the reason for that is, frankly, just it's a combination of things. But if we were to actually look at the raw color information here, there's actually some portions of, just because of the width of the image, there's some portions of the image that are represented by more red pixels than others. So in other words, there's small sort of imperceivable bands in here that are perhaps a little bit wider, that have more prominence in certain regions than other regions. And so we get this sort of imperfect look, especially when we use tools like this. Typically, when we're working with images or with actual photographic images, it looks a lot smoother because we're looking at actual real world data. But when we generate this data ourselves, like I just used the gradient tool in Photoshop to get this photo, then typically you'll sort of get this a little bit of error involved within it. So now I've mentioned that there are other types of histograms as well. And one other type of histogram is actually a channel histogram. And this channel will show you all of the bytes of information that exist in each individual color channel. So what is a color channel? A color channel is just looking at each individual red, green, or blue rather than each of those as a whole. So if we were to just look at this image in terms of its red content, we would have another histogram altogether. Now, if we had something that looks only at the red, so if we had a histogram that counts from 0 to 255 the values of red, so 0 being the complete absence of red and 255 being the complete presence of red, what would the histogram for this image look like? Yep, right, a bar all the way on the right. Right, and that might seem counterintuitive because we're losing red, but that doesn't mean that in terms of the computer that these pixels on the far right are losing red. Remember that all white is made up of 255 of each of these colors. So 255 for red, 255 for green, 255 for blue in combination make white. So if we have the color white, that means that we have the value 255 for red. So as we start adding more and more lightness to this image, we're just increasing the values of these other colors. So for a red channel histogram, we just have one spike at the very far end because every single pixel in this image has 255 for a value for red. Now, what about for green? If we were to take a look at the green channel histogram instead. And this one, again, it's similar to red, except it looks at the distribution of green values in the pixels here instead of red. So we have some pixels that have, what, over here, do these pixels have any green? Nope. And what about over here? Do these pixels have some green? Yes, and in fact, it sort of smoothly goes from the absence of green to the presence of green. So if we were to look at a green channel histogram, it would actually look like this, where there's actually the complete extension from pixels that have no green in them at all the way to pixels that do have green in them, that have the complete presence of green. Now, what about blue? How would blue look? Would it look similar to the red? Right, it would be similar to the green because it's doing the exact same thing as the green. On the far left, there's absolutely no blue, but we're adding more and more blue in order to make our white region of this image. So our blue histogram would look like this. Now, you might say that you've never seen perhaps individual histograms for individual color channels. You can actually view this in Photoshop, but typically what you see is a combination of these three. And the combination is called a color histogram, where they take each individual channel. They take the blue, they plop it on top of the green. Then they take that combination, blue-green, and they plop it on top of the red, and that is called a color histogram. So we have now, in addition to the luminance histogram, we have a color histogram. You notice that now it's become cyan, and that's because it's combined both blue and green at each of these positions. So we can see that both blue and green extend all the way from 0 all the way to 255, and then at the very high end, there's this black bar representing the complete presence of all three of those of that color information. Okay, so what is RGB actually showing us? This is actually much more of an average. This is actually an average of all of the three. It takes the three color channel information. So it takes the red channel, the green channel, and the blue channel, and it averages all of this information. So what we talked about before, when we said a reasonable person might take those three colors, average them together, that is what the RGB is effectively showing us. You'll notice that it appears different from the luminance histogram because what it is showing us is the actual values of the red, the green, and the blue, and not the apparent brightness of the image. And that is the distinction between these two types of graphs, is that one will show you the apparent brightness of the image, how we perceive the brightness of this image. The other shows us the actual values that make up the color information in that image. So RGB, we can see that there are some pixels that have zero value, and there are some pixels that have all values. So this is the white region, and this is just an average amount. So 255 for red, plus zero divided by 3 gives us a certain value, and that is sort of what we are seeing over here, this average of all of these three values. Now, what these two things show us is actually very distinct, and it can actually lead to different problems depending on which histogram we are actually looking at. Many cameras these days show us the luminance histogram. Pretty much most. Most SLRs will show us the luminance histogram. Many compact cameras will show us luminance histogram, but not all of them do. Some of them will show you RGB, some of them will show you luminance, and not all will actually tell you which one you're using. If you have a fancy modern camera, it's very possible that you can actually pick which histogram you want it to show you, but for many of you, that may not be the case, where you don't have an option, you're shown a histogram, you're not told what it is, you have to figure out what it is on your own. Now, it's important to realize that these two types of histograms can show us different information depending on the type of image. So let's say that we take a photograph that looks like this ridiculous thing up here. And obviously, I don't know what planet you'll have to be on to take an image that looks like this. But if you happen to take one that looks like this, your histograms will look very different depending on which one you are using. The luminance histogram, the one that we've learned how to calculate and we've spent the most of our time on, is shown on the right. And this RGB histogram, the one that shows the average of all of these values, is shown on the left. And you can see how different these two histograms actually are. So what we are seeing is different things, like I've said. So if we were to take a look at the luminance histogram, we can see that there are no black pixels whatsoever. And if we look at the image, that's certainly true. It's the complete presence of all of these distinct colors, but they never meld completely to form white, and they never disappear completely to form black. So in terms of the luminance histogram, we have sort of a narrow tonal range that extends from blue all the way up to green, and that's it. And because we have regions of this image that are predominantly these individual colors that are predominantly red, that are predominantly green, that are predominantly blue, we see spikes at each of those percentages. So we see spikes at 10%, we see spikes at 30%, and spikes at about 60%, showing us the relative intensities of each of these colors. Now, if I actually had taken this image, I would actually say that we have lost some detail due to something called clipping. So we've talked about at length overexposure and how overexposure is bad, because what will happen is that you will cause some portions of your image to lose detail because it's so bright. It's too white for you to be able to actually capture detail in those regions as well. But this can happen on an individual color channel as well. If you take a picture of a red flower, for example, that red can be so strong, can be so overwhelming, that you can actually lose detail in that red, in red portions of that image. And you get what's called clipping at an individual color channel, but you don't, it's not necessarily overexposure, if that difference makes sense. So you lose detail in the red because that red is so bright that the camera can't resolve the red, but it's not overexposed in the true sense of the word that we've been talking about. And that's sort of shown here. Like, none of this image is technically overexposed. But we can see that because there's regions that are completely red, that are completely green, that are completely blue, then this means that there's perhaps additional detail that we've lost due to clipping. So we don't see that necessarily become so apparent in this luminosity histogram. Like, there's this huge gap between the spike for green and what we would call overexposure, or the region of the histogram that we would start to worry about overexposure. But if we had an RGB histogram, we can see that there are indeed pixels that have values of 255, which means that the camera cannot resolve any detail that's any brighter than that in this color region. So this RGB histogram is actually showing us that we have perhaps some color clipping at various pixels within this image that the luminance histogram doesn't really make so apparent. Now that you understand that there's spikes at 10, 30, and 60%, you might see these spikes and say, oh man, maybe there's some clipping going on. But in real world photographs, you're not going to see necessarily big spikes that look like this. They're going to be much less apparent. And even knowing what you know now, it's going to be much harder to spot clipping with a luminance histogram than you will with a red histogram. So the RGB is good for very strong clipping. The RGB histogram is good to use when you have a very predominant amount of one color, or very, very strong colors in your image. The RGB histogram is good to use because the luminosity histogram may not tell you when you're clipping those individual color channels, when the RGB histogram will show you that you in fact are. Now, if you have a regular distribution of colors, then the luminosity histogram becomes much more useful because you will be likely to overexpose all of them, or you'll overexpose white pixels rather than some individual color channel. So if you're trying to determine in your camera which type of histogram you have, it's good to use to take a photo that is predominantly very strong color. So you want to have some very, very strong color in your image, not a mix of color, but some very strong color, and you'll be able to see. If you have a big distribution like this, perhaps you have RGB, but if you have one very strong color, like you take a picture of something that's very, very red, and you see an individual spike that's like 30% of the way, you can be reasonably sure that that is because you have a luminance histogram. Now, to bring this to a little bit closer to home, imagine that we took a photo that looks like this. And it is, again, it's a nice photo, but we have these areas of the photo that are very heavily they have a lot of very strong color. So there's some red in here that's very, very strong. And in fact, to see this clipping that I'm talking about, let's zoom in just a little bit. We can see that we have some portions of these flowers that have detail, and then all of a sudden we've lost the detail. They're so red that we don't see any sort of like additional detail within them, any folds within the flowers, or anything that would be interesting in detail for this flower. So we have in this photo color clipping in the red color channel. And if we take a look at the luminance histogram for this, this actually appears to be well exposed, as it is. It looks like it's a well exposed image. But what we're missing out on the luminosity histogram is the fact that we have these very heavy spikes, or we are clipping an individual color channel. So if we take a look at the red channel histogram by itself, we can see we have a good distribution of tones, but we have a spike at the far end, at the complete bright, at a value of 255 for red, which indicates to us that we are clipping some data at this red channel. Yes?
I guess the natural question is, how do you avoid clipping? How do you preserve data?
So avoiding clipping is actually a difficult thing to do. If you have a choice, you can try to do something. So if you are using like a polarizing filter, for example, you might take it off, or you might tone down the amount of the polarizing effect just because you are enhancing the contrast with that particular filter. Another thing that you could do is to try to even out the number of colors within it and then collectively underexpose the image. That would be tough without modifying this particular image. Frankly, a lot of times you can't really solve clipping issues very, very easily without doing some fancy work in software or underexposing it later, which makes the whole thing look underexposed, and then try to expose it or re-expose it at a proper brightness later on. Another thing you could do is just to decrease the contrast on your camera. If you're taking JPEG pictures especially, what will happen is that they try to increase the contrast a little bit to make the photos look like they pop, that they have a lot of good saturation and color to them. You might try turning that down a little bit in the camera if you're taking JPEG photos. But there's no sort of cure-all for this problem. It is a problem, but it's useful. Well, it is useful for this image. I would say, you know, I could show you this image, and had I not pointed out the clipping, you'd probably find it acceptable. But if you take a photo of a flower individually, and that flower is you take a photo of one of these flowers, and you have, you know, clipped the entire flower, that is something that you would then have to try to pay more attention to. Decrease the saturation, bring down the exposure a little bit so it's not quite as bright, fix it later in post-production, or any number of things like that. Maybe use a color filter if you have them in front of your lens. Yes? Clipping with film. So film is much more resilient to these sorts of problems than digital cameras are. Overexposing and clipping in film, while it does happen, it has a much better response. So you're much more likely to still see some details before it becomes very obvious. This is sort of a problem with digital cameras, and it's more unique to digital than I would say to film. Even though the problem is present, it's just not as big of an issue in the end. Any other questions? Okay, so the takeaway from this is that you can use RGB to try to determine if there's color clipping, which you can see. Luminosity is useful, but only for the brightness of the image as a whole. It won't tell you if you're clipping individual color channels, or you can try to use an individual color histogram to determine the same. All right, thank you all for coming. We will see you next week. Don't forget, I think the next assignment is due then as well. Oh, by the way, because next Monday is a holiday, we will not have sections on Monday. The extension school is closed, so we will only have sections tonight and the following Tuesday. Then we'll resume our normal schedule.